So hi everyone, welcome to today's colloquium. We are very happy to have Isabel Cordero Carrion joining us from Spain, where she designed the logo of the autism group. No, so she's a professor at the University of Valencia. She and also an Emmy Noether Fellow at Perimeter Institute. Unfortunately, one of the things that the pandemic did not let happen was her visit, but we're looking forward for it happening sometime in the near future. Just a few words about her trajectory. She got her PhD in Valencia, and from there did two stints of postdocs, one at the Paris Observatory and another one at the Max Planck Institute for Astrophysics. So her work straddles in some ways two very ends of the spectra. On one hand, the very mathematical study or structure of Einstein's equations and how to deal with them, and at the very other end, immerse into one of the most complex computational physics problems nowadays, which is to understand the role of microphysics and neutrino propagations in core collapse supernova. So she covers both ends of that spectrum, and today she's going to be talking about the fully constrained formulation, local uniqueness, and numerical accuracy. Thank you, Isabel. Go ahead when you are ready.
Okay, well, first of all, huge thanks to the Perimeter Institute for organizing this colloquium for the award, because for me it was really somehow unexpected and a very, very good news. And this year we need this good news. So I am really looking forward to be able to visit you. As Luis was saying before, this will mean good news for me, for Canada, for the Perimeter Institute, and for everyone. So thank you. Thank you also, Luis, for the introduction. Very nice introduction. I am professor in the Faculty of Mathematics. Actually, I was always between applied mathematics and astrophysics. And I think that's a good point, because we need diversity in our groups. And I hope these collaborations will be stronger in the future. And I do welcome people coming from mathematics and from physics to collaborate and to work together. For me, it was a very fruitful and enjoyable collaboration. So I'm going to talk about formalisms of Einstein equations. I will try to give a global overview, and I will finish with something more specific of what I am doing right now. So I will start with a general motivation of why general relativity is important. Then I will talk a little about what are elliptic equations and hyperbolic equations. And in particular, I will give some main properties of these equations to understand why we need to consider this difference between the two kind of equations. Then we'll talk about how actually we solve Einstein equations in the computers. So what is this 3+1 formalism, and what's that free evolution and constraint formulation means? And then I will focus on a particular scheme approach in the case of constraint formulations. I have been working since my PhD. So I will start with the elliptic part, which is associated to the so-called conformally flat condition. And I will comment about a mathematical problem that can have huge implications in the numerical resolution of the equations. And then I will talk about the hyperbolic structure and what we are doing in the last month and here in Valencia, together with my PhD student, Samuel Santos Pérez. And I will then conclude with some brief comments and summary and future steps. Okay, so why general relativity? Why we don't, I mean, we have to go beyond Newton's theory of gravity. Because there are some scenarios, some astrophysical scenarios, that Newton's gravity is not enough to really model with accuracy the process we want to analyze or we want to study. So, for example, in the case of equation of states that includes matter higher than nuclear density, you need to consider a mass an equation of a state that do include a very different behaviors. And for these equations of states and for this understanding of the matter with very, very high densities, you need to include general relativity. In Newtonian gravity, for example, you don't have a maximum mass of compact objects, but for example, in general relativity, you have a maximum of a possible masses of these compact objects, and if you go above this limit, then the dynamical evolution probably will collapse to a black hole. So the dynamical evolution of very compact objects is very different if you go from Newtonian gravity to general relativity. And also, this is, let's say, important if you want also to consider other equations, other scenarios that include the matter content. So, for example, Luis was also mentioning the supernova core collapse. So you can consider the magnetohydrodynamic equations, but then you need to incorporate the relativistic and even relativistic resistivity effects if you want to really model what's going on there. If you don't consider matter content, then there is also two important actors that appear in general relativity that are not in the Newtonian gravity, which are black holes and gravitational waves. So these phenomena are basically non-existent in Newtonian gravity. In the case of black holes, it's a very complex problem because you need to deal with a very high curvature of the space-time and also deal with the formation of singularity if you don't include, let's say, quantum effects in this modelization. Also, in the case of gravitational waves, it's very important and it's one of the state-of-the-art topics nowadays with the Nobel Prizes and with LIGO, Virgo, CAGRA, GEO 600 observatories going on. And these gravitational waves are new if you go from Newton to Einstein equations. And then I will also mention this gravitational lensing, which is an effect appearing in general relativity. And for example, people doing galaxy structure, cosmology. This is also very important in the accurate treatment of the modelization of this kind of problems. So I hope I was able to convince you that you do need general relativity when you want to understand and analyze some astrophysical scenarios. And actually, you can find almost in every country a nice painting about general relativity equations with a very compact formula. So here you have like a picture of an schematic picture gravitational lensing effect I was mentioning before, and also with the Einstein equations in a very compact formula. This is very nice, but this is actually far from what we need to solve. So if you write all these terms with the definitions, if you consider a particular choice of coordinates and you put everything there, actually we are talking about a nonlinear partial differential equations, which is coupled, this system of equations is coupled with matter evolution content in the case of non-vacuum spacetimes. If you want to understand some scenarios like supernova, then you need to include neutrino radiation. And maybe if you want to include other like bosonic fields, other matter content, then you need to include more equations. So at the end, this is a very complex problem. And actually, it was in the last decades that the field called numerical relativity, which tries to solve numerically these equations, was let's say, having a very great impact and development in all the groups around the world. So in order to, let's say, solve these equations analytically or numerically, you need to consider some kind of initial data problem. So you start with some initial data in one space-like or null-like hypersurface, and then you try to evolve somehow this initial data to construct your whole space-time. So the first point is that the way you slide, you foliate the space-time is not a degree of freedom. It's more a choice you can do. So there are two main, let's say, approaches. One is called the 2+2 formalism, which the idea is that you foliate the space-time by null cones. And this was, for example, very important in the analytical derivation of properties of the gravitational radiation at the spatial and null infinity, the understanding of what gravitational waves really are, and it was very, very important. It has some problems, and because of this, let's say, numerical or geometrical problems, there is other option, which is the so-called 3+1 formalism. And here you can have a look to the first works by Lisnerowitz and Jughead Bruhat. The idea here is, let's say, go to something you are more familiar, which is start from some space-like hypersurfaces, put them some initial data, and try to evolve in time this initial data. So you will, again, at the end, you will have the whole space-time you want to understand, you want to analyze, you want to study. So here, what we are talking about, this is the most commonly used approach in numerical relativity. We are talking about basically a Cauchy problem with some partial differential equations with initial data and some boundary conditions that can be also very complex depending on the scenario you are numerically solving. Okay, so now before going to the equations and talking about why we separate in different sectors and which kind of equations I am going to talk about, let me just briefly comment about what elliptic and hyperbolic partial differential equation means. I will give just a very short mathematical definition, but more important, I will give you some examples and some basic ideas and properties of these equations. So first of all, when you want to analyze the character, the mathematical, but also this will have a huge impact in the numerical simulations. When you want to analyze the character of a partial differential equation, you have to look to the higher order derivatives of this system of equations. When you are talking about elliptic equations, the mathematical definition is that when you consider, well, if you have, let's say, a completely general differential operator of this form, so this capital D represents derivatives in a very general way, and this alpha is just some coefficients. So then you consider a non-null vector, and you have a look to the higher order derivatives, and you have a look to this combination. So in the case of elliptic equations, the point is that this combination has a defined sign, so it is always positive or it is always negative. And this will give you the elliptic character of this system of equations. This can be very abstract, and actually, usually the people have a look to the definition when you consider only second order derivatives and you have a more simplified definition. If you go to higher derivatives, you can use this general definition. But this is just a mathematical definition that may don't say anything about what's going on there, no? So the first point here is the main example of elliptic equations is the so-called Laplace equation. For example, heat equations are modeled by elliptic equations. In the case of the Laplace operator, the Laplace equation, if you use Cartesian coordinates, it can be written, the operator can be written in this way. So all the coefficients multiplying the higher derivatives is one. So at the end, when you consider this vector, you have a quantity which is always positive. Okay, so as I was mentioning before, this is really a very theoretical definition, and it's not very convenient when you want to treat it numerically. So it is good to know the main properties of these kind of equations. And this is usually what I have in mind when then I go to the numerical resolution of the equations. So here the point is, these kind of equations are like teenagers. I want to say this is like teenagers. So the point here is that the solution of these equations in the whole domain is completely determined by the values that you put in the boundary. So it's like a teenager in the sense that you can only knock the door of the teenager room, but you cannot touch too much more. So for example, if you consider previous equations, but in two dimensions, and then you put this just arbitrary boundary conditions, the solution in the whole domain is completely determined only given these boundary values, these values of the function at the boundaries. And this is a graphical representation of the solution. So here, basically, I just give the values at the boundary, and then the rest of the values of the function, the rest in the rest of the domain, are completely determined by this boundary. So this can be interpreted from a physical point of view as an infinite speed propagation, in the sense that if I change slightly the value of the function somewhere at the boundary, for example, if I change only the value around this corner here, then the whole solution will change. Not only the solution will change locally around the points I have done the change in the boundary, at the boundary. So this is like, very careful, you cannot put something which is not consistent, because then everything will be completely wrong. This is one of the reasons that people in general in numerical simulations try to avoid these kind of equations, because you need to be really very careful of what you are doing. Physically, these equations used to represent some constraints or some restrictions. And for example, in the case of general relativity, we will talk about Hamiltonian constraint or momentum constraint. Okay, let's go now to the hyperbolic equation. So first of all, the mathematical definition is that you have an evolution equation on our evolution system of equations written in this way. And actually, the point is that if you consider the eigenvalues and eigenvectors problem associated to the differential terms of this system of equations, you get a set of real eigenvalues and a complete basis of real eigenvectors. Again, this is just a mathematical definition, but this is more important for me here to give you some examples and also some main properties of these kind of equations. So first of all, the more basic, let's say, I would say the more simple example of hyperbolic equations are wave equations. So any kind of waves in general are modeled by these kind of hyperbolic equations. In the case of an spherical wave, you have this equation here, and you can get a general solution of this form, where you see that there are like two directions of propagation of the wave, one encoded in this G1 depending on R minus T, and the other direction of propagation encoded in this G2 function with depending on R plus T. Okay, so which are the main properties of this kind of hyperbolic equations? First of all, these equations have a finite velocity of propagation, and these velocities are given by the values of the eigenvalues of the system. Then this information propagates at finite velocity, and propagate along the directions determined by the eigenvectors. So actually, this information, these eigenvalues and eigenvectors, are not only important because of the definition, but they are very important because they're giving us a very, let's say, a very good idea of what's going on. We know which kind of propagation is propagating in which directions and how fast or how slow. And we can then design the numerical method to really solve these equations. Okay, in the case of general relativity, the eigenvalues are always bounded by the speed of light in vacuum. So that's why we know that anything can be can move faster than the speed of light in vacuum. Okay, then the point here in the case of hyperbolic equations, given some initial data, the values of the function at the boundaries are not completely determined or fixed, or let's say are completely free. In this case, these values strongly depend on the directions of propagation of the information determined by the eigenvalues. And what you put in this boundary should be consistent with all this information that you or you know, or you can have some estimation of this characteristic structure. So here, the good news of hyperbolic equations is that if you change slightly the value of the function somewhere, then the solution will only change locally according to this finite propagation of the information. So this is one of the main reasons why when you solve a numerically Einstein equations, you try to maximize hyperbolic equations. And then from a physical point of view, the hyperbolic equations are behind the evolution of most phenomena. So fluid dynamics, traffic dynamics, also gravitational waves, evolution, or whatever. Anything that you have some kind of evolution or propagation, and this scenario will be modeled most probably by hyperbolic equations. In this case, in the case of elliptic equations, the solution tends to be very smooth and very regular, but in the case of hyperbolic equations, even if you start from very initially smooth data, the evolution of the equations can lead to the formation of shocks and discontinuities, and then you need to take care about that. For example, in the case of matter content, this is very common, and you need to include specific numerical methods to deal with this point. Okay, so after this like mean introduction about what elliptic and hyperbolic equations are, let me go back to Einstein equations and what I was mentioning before, these 3+1 formulations. So here the point is that you have like some initial data with some space-like hypersurfaces and you evolve your data a long time. And this has this is an schematic view of what we do in our codes. There are physical motivations for let me say that the way you slice this space-time, even if you consider some initial data and then you evolve, the way you slice this space-time is completely free. It's something that is called gauge freedom. So you can freely choose the more desired or convenient foliation. And what are the choices, the more common choices? So there are physical motivations. For example, if you want to include a black hole in your numerical simulation, you don't want to get to touch the singularity because you know that your code will completely crash at that point. There are also mathematical motivations. It's important that the resulting system of partial differential equations have good mathematical properties because this will give you also guarantee about the numerical results you get. And also there are purely, let's say, numerical motivations related to the stability of long-term numerical simulations in the case of supernova explosions, for example, the way you can have a very, let's say, a more efficient evolution. That's because these simulations are very expensive from a computational point of view. So anything you can do for reducing the computational cost is also very welcome. So let's say basically you decide because of different reasons which is your favorite foliation, and this is determined by this n vector and this beta vector. This n vector is just the, well, not only the n vector, but this factor in front. This factor in front is called the Laffe function, and basically tells you which is the proper time between one slice and the other and the next one in the foliation you have choose. And then this beta is just a shift vector and describe how spatial coordinates are shift from one spatial hypersurface to the next one. This is very technical, but basically these two quantities tell you how you have a sliced space-time in this case. And they are completely free in this sense. It's the choice you want to do. And then what you do is you project the metric of space-time onto this hypersurface, and you get this three metric. And then you have the metric element, which is given in terms of this last function, beta vector, and this gamma ij, which is the three metric, the metric onto the projection of the metric onto the hypersurfaces. Then you have this quantity, which is called the extrinsic curvature, which is basically telling you how these hypersurfaces is embedded in the whole space-time. So this is just to give you the idea of which kind of variables appear in the equations. The first, the Laffe and the shift are completely free. And then the Einstein equations basically tell you how the three metric and the extrinsic curvature evolves in time from some initial data. So I'm not going to show you all the equations, but you can believe me that if you take Einstein equations, and there are two set of equations depending on the components that you consider. If you consider the purely spatial components, what you have is an evolution equation for the three metric components, and also for the extrinsic curvature. And this is somehow like a wave-like system of equations. And then if you consider the non-purely spatial components, what you have is not evolution equations, but constraint equations. You have four constraint equations, which are called the Hamiltonian and the momentum constraints. So this is something that during the evolution equations, you have to, in addition, fulfill all these constraint equations. So from an analytical point of view, if the initial data, if the initial data satisfies the constraint equations, then the evolution equations will keep these constraints to be satisfied. But I am talking from a theoretical point of view. If you try to do this in a numerical code, most probably you will not keep, let's say, the constraint equations. You will not verify the constraint equations in general. So you need to take very carefully into account these constraint equations. The idea of the so-called free evolution schemes is that you basically just, this just is a very simplified version, but let's say in the free evolution schemes, what you do is you just evolve the hyperbolic equations, the evolution equations, and then you use the elliptic equations, the constraint equations, to monitor the level of error of your numerical simulation. One of the most important schemes that you can have in this free evolution schemes is a so-called BSSN, which has, well, it was used Mostly, every group has a code with BSSN, even if you have another formulation. It has been studied during the last decades, and we all know that it has a lot of good mathematical and numerical properties. So, for example, the system of equations is strongly hyperbolic and well-posed. So it is like a very good option if you want to consider these pre-evolution schemes. There are other examples, but I will not go into detail. Then you have the other approach, which is the so-called constrained evolution in schemes. That's the idea is that, okay, I will solve the evolution equations, but I am not very sure about the verification of the constraint equations, and I am going to really solve also the constraint equations. And this is basically what I have been doing in my research lines. I want to say that even if I focus on these constrained evolution schemes, some of the conclusions that we got then they were applied into free evolution schemes. So this is not like two different teams that don't talk each other. It's just two different approaches. And sometimes when you learn something on one approach, you can also go to other approach and try to understand better the problem. So when we talk about different formulations, what we are talking actually is about different gauge conditions or different variables, auxiliary variables to solve the system. So let me focus in these constraint equations, as I mentioned, in this constraint formalisms. As I mentioned before, the point here is that I do not trust too much my numerical scheme, because maybe I need a very long simulation or whatever. And I really want to solve the constraint equations at every moment, at every space-like hypersurface. So the first approach is the so-called conformally flat condition that was introduced by Isenberg a few years ago. And here the double date is because actually he didn't publish his work. And it was really like a few years after that a lot of people were using this approximation, and it was so successful that they asked him to please publish the work about this approximation. So this scheme assumes that the spatial free metric is conformally flat. So in the sense that you can write this three metric as a conformal factor and another metric, and this other metric is just the flat metric. Basically, if you think about what you are doing, it's not an exact approach. So it's an approximation let's say, instant equations. But it's very important, and it has been used in a lot of astrophysical scenarios. For example, one thing, even if it is an approximation at the very beginning, it can be proved that this is no longer an approximation, but it is exact in the case of spherical symmetry. And if you go to axisymmetry, for example, if you consider axisymmetric rotating neutron stars, then this is not an exact approximation. This is not an exact formulation, but this is an approximation. But even though, this is very, very accurate, and it has been used in a lot of simulations of rotating axisymmetric rotating compact objects. And I'm talking here about neutron stars, so the compactness here is very high. It's true that because of this approximation, you are neglecting the terms which encode the gravitational radiation of the system. So in this case, in this approximation, you only have a set of elliptic equations for the metric variables that remains, which are the Laplace function, the shape vector, and this conformal factor that I have just introduced. So somehow what you are saying is that I am neglecting the gravitational radiation of the system, and the only thing that I have to do is to solve the constraints coming from Einstein equations. And that's why we end up with a set of elliptic equations. As I mentioned, even if this is an approximation, it has been used in the collapse of rotating cores of massive stars. And even if you neglect the gravitational, let's say the terms encoding the gravitational radiation, you can get a very good estimate of the gravitational radiation from the evolution of the matter content. It has been also used in the case of evolution of binary system of neutron stars and black holes. And here I have to mention the work by Andreas Bausbein. The point of this approach is that it shares a very similar structure with an scheme cool XCTS, extending conformal thin sandwich. And this scheme is basically a very popular and common scheme to generate initial data. So even if you are not interested in constraint schemes for the evolution of your equations, you need to compute some initial data. And in the case of computing initial data, you need to have a look to these constraint formulations. Okay, so basically this is just to show you what kind of equations we are solving. I'm not going to enter into detail. Basically you have these star terms are the matter content, and then this Kij is encoding the extrinsic curvature and is encoding the curvature of the space-time. So if you take these equations, which are the original equations in the conformally flat conditional approximation, you can derive that this original set of elliptic equations suffer from a very important mathematical problem. So they suffer from what is called non-local uniqueness pathology, when the curvature of the spacetime you are solving is very, very high, or when you are considering very high density regimes. I'm not going into details, but there is basically a maximum principle, let's say a mathematical theorem, that tells you that you have a wrong sign in the equations that does not allow you to warranty this local uniqueness. And what I want to show here, to show you here, is that it is not just a mathematical issue. If you go to simulations, and that's what matters also here, if you go to simulations, you can have very weird phenomena. So here, what I am showing you, is the case of evolution of a vacuum space with an initial data formed by a Gaussian wave packet and a small amplitude. I think we were using spherical symmetry, so this is no longer an approximation. I mean, the problem was not because it was an approximation. The problem was because the mathematical equations had the bad properties. And the point is that the evolution of this Gaussian wave packet is that it goes to the center of, in spherical symmetry, you have some defined the definition of a center. So you have this wave which goes to the center and then disperse to infinity. And in general, you should not get any numerical problem. If the amplitude is small, if the amplitude of the wave is small, you don't have any problem. But if you consider a high amplitude, the behavior of this wave packet is that this wave packet collapses and forms a black hole. So what you have here is a plot of the value of the lapse at the center and also the value of the ADM mass of the system. So what you expect from the central value of the lapse function, because you are forming a black hole, you expect that this value goes to zero. At the beginning, it does goes to a lower value, closer to zero. And then from the ADM mass of the system, because it's it should be a constant value, it's a quantity that should be conserved, then what you expect is having a constant value, maybe some small differences because of numerical errors, but it should be a constant. And this is also what you see at the beginning of the simulation. But When the black hole is almost, I mean, when you have this formation of the black hole and the curvature is increasing and the density is increasing at the center of this space-time, then this warranty, this warranty that you can, you don't have local uniqueness in your equations, produces a very weird phenomenon in your numerical simulations. What happened is that you basically jump to another completely different and unstable solution of your equations. And in this case, what you have is you have this jump with this like these oscillations, then you have this jump, and then you go to another completely smooth, completely fine, let's say, no stability solution of the of these values. And in the case of the ADM mask, what you have is you have this constant value, everything is more or less okay, and then you start to have problems with these oscillations, and you jump to another completely different value of the ADM mask. This is basically telling you that you were in a configuration and you have jumped to another completely different configuration because you don't have warranty of local uniqueness. And when you do, let's say, a slightly change in the values of your variables, and here when you are dealing with numerical resolution, this is because this is, let's say, inherent from numerical simulations, you have this different this the difference in the values of the variables, and you just jump to another thing which has nothing to do with the problem you were studying at the beginning. So this is not like a mathematical artifact, but this is something that will have huge implications in the numerical simulations you want to perform. So here, basically, we were able to solve this problem by, let's say, introducing auxiliary variables and rewriting the extrinsic curvature as a conformal decomposition, and this a new variable, a capital hat, written in terms of another decomposition. So I'm not going into details, but the point is that you need to rewrite your equations, and in particular, rewrite the extrinsic curvature variable in terms of other variables. So you end up with an equivalent system in the sense that you are not solving a different equations at the end, but the variables that you are using are different, and the mathematical system of partial differential equations that you end up is also different. So again, I'm not going to detail, but in these equations, this is the set of elliptic equations that you end up if you consider these new auxiliary variables. And the star term represents matter content, and this capital A hat are related to the extrinsic curvature and therefore are associated to the curvature of space-time. And the point of this new system is that now you can use this mathematical theorem to guarantee local uniqueness of the system. And moreover, you have a very nice properties because you can solve these highly nonlinear elliptic equations in a hierarchical structure. So first you solve the equation for this x variable, then you solve the elliptic equation for the conformal factor, then you solve for the Lax function, and then you solve for the shift vector. And the fact that you can decouple, let's say, in this hierarchical structure the equations also gets you a lot of, let's say, reduction in the computational time and the computational resources you need to solve these equations. This is called the extended conformally flat condition scheme, and it was implemented in several codes. For example, you can have a look to the coconut code we are using here in Valencia, or also the X-ECO code from Bucciantini and Dersana, and there are more examples. Okay, so let me just show, if you don't believe too much in mathematics or you are like a little skeptic about this mathematical theorem, if you try to reproduce the very same simulation I was showing you before, but now with this new system of elliptic equations, You see that there are no problems now. So here you have, on one hand, the migration of an unstable neutron star to the stable branch, and we also perform a simulation of a collapse of an unstable neutron star to a black hole. And in both cases, everything was smooth. In the first column, you see the simulations, the profiles for the first migration of unstable neutron star to the stable branch simulation. So you have here the central density and the central value of the labs, and you see everything is quite smooth and expected, so everything is fine. And then if you go to the collapse of the unstable neutron star to a black hole, that was giving a lot of problems. Now it's everything is smooth. So you see here the central value of the labs and the central value of the density, and everything is smooth. These vertical dashed lines is just the moment where the black hole is formed, and you see that you can continue the simulation. I mean, this is just that we end up the simulation, but not because the code crashed. And here you have also a plot talking about the mass inside the apparent horizon and the radius of the apparent horizon. So everything was quite smooth and consistent with the results we were expecting. Okay, so this is like the, I was talking about this conformally flat DCFC scheme. This is just an approximation, but if you don't neglect these terms in this approximation, you can consider, the previous approach is just a particular case of a more general and completely exact formulation of Einstein equations, which is called the fully relativistic scheme. This was developed by people in the Meudon Observatory close to Paris in France. As I was mentioning before, you need just to tell me which are your favorite values for your gauge variables, and then we end up with a particular formulation. So in this case, the gauges are maximal slicing and generalized Dirac gauge. This is very technical, but just to give you the definitions. Also perform a conformal three a conformal decomposition of the free metric and the extrinsic curvature, similar to what we did in the CFC scheme in order to solve the local uniqueness problem. And basically what you end up if you have two kind of sectors, two sectors in the equations. You have an elliptic sector, which is very similar to the CFC scheme with some additional extra terms in the source terms. And then you have a new hyperbolic sector, which encodes the evolution of the terms encoding, let's say, the gravitational radiation of the system. Why we are using this fully constrained scheme that, is not this free evolution scheme? One thing is what I mentioned before. In very long-term simulations, you need to control the violation of the constraints. And also, the problem was, in some cases, that solving in a numerical way elliptic equations is not always easy. And here I want to show you just a brief comment about it can be done, even if you use finite differences grid. It can be done in a way that you can parallelize the problem. And I just let here the method that we developed in 2017 about Jacobi, generalized Jacobi methods in order to solve this kind of elliptic equations. So this was one of the main problems of not including elliptic equations in numerical simulations. And then for the hyperbolic equations, you need to take care of the fact that you have a wave equation at the end. It's a very complex wave equation, but at the end you have a wave equation. And you need to take into account this wave behavior in order to solve the equations numerically. And we were using the so-called partially implicit Runge-Kutta methods in order to deal with this hyperbolic sector encoding the gravitational radiation of the system. Actually, the work developed in for the hyperbolic sector was then applied into the hyperbolic sector of free evolution schemes. So this is basically the elliptic sector in this formulation. I don't want to give you more details, but basically it's very similar to what we had before with some additional extra source terms. And then you have these elliptic, these hyperbolic equations, which are encoding the gravitational radiation of the system. And you have, if you are familiar with, for example, BSSN formulation, at the end you have some evolution of a variable related to the metric of the space-time, and also the evolution of another variable related to extrinsic curvature, which are the two equations showed here. So let me finish with this in this colloquium with the last words I am doing in collaboration with my PhD student Samuel Santos, that that is doing let's say the more numerical work of this part. So on one hand, you can think about previous equations. So these elliptic equations are basically the ones I showed before. They have very good mathematical properties. And then you have this evolution sector, which was not very explored yet. So we were thinking also about what happened with the numerical accuracy of the system. So here you have the expansion of the metric variables in terms of inverse powers of velocity of light. And you can get all the details in this reference here by French group. And the idea here is to try to rewrite the equations in such a way that we are improving the numerical accuracy of the equations. So don't focus on all the terms. Just let me explain what I want to show here. If you consider the evolution equations that I was mentioning before, you see that there is a part of the source terms which are much bigger. Let's say in this expansion in 1/c terms, they are much bigger than the variable that you are really solving, and that the variable that you want to really solve numerically. So this can lead to a very, let's say, to important numerical inaccuracies in the evolution of in the evolution of your system. And what we wanted to do is to include or modify the equations in such a way that even if we modify a little the elliptic sector, we keep the very good properties of local uniqueness of the elliptic sector, but we improve the numerical accuracy of this hyperbolic sector. So the idea is to change the chief vector, not change, but let's say introduce a new auxiliary variable, which is this V. At the end, it's like we replace the equations for beta for the equations for V, but you can always recover, let's say, all the variables appearing in the metric variables of space-time. So I'm not going to give a lot of details, but basically we are working with this new variable. Then the elliptic sector is very similar. You keep some of the elliptic equations and you replace some other ones in order to consider terms which will be more will have more accuracy, will have more numerical accuracy. And also you need to add extra equations, extra variables, because of the dynamics, let's say, of the dynamical behavior of the system. With this new variable, it's not a very big change. We still have guarantee of local uniqueness, and we have this hierarchical structure in the elliptic equations, but we have found that we are solving better, we have more numerical accuracy in the resolution of the metric variables. So with this new variable, what you have is that the evolution equation for the quantity related to the metric of space-time now has a very good behavior, talking about this 1/c expansion. And then for the evolution of the quantity related to the extrinsic curvature, we still have some, let's say, problems dealing with this accuracy, but we are working on that. Maybe this is very wonderful from general relativity. So when you have a problem, Also, you have a good estimate for solving the problem. So for the first evolution equation, we solve the problem. We are finishing the checks and the and some numerical exam some numerical resolutions I will show at the end for finishing the talk. But for this second equation, even if we are not able to reduce the correct expansion, let's say the correct order in this expansion in terms of 1 over c, we are having some idea for a potential estimate of the gravitational radiation of the system without needing to solve the evolution equations. This is something that we wanted to finish, and maybe if potentially we can, I can visit you soon at the Perimeter Institute, I can give you more details about this part. Just to finish, let me show you about this numerical computation of the new elliptic sector with this new variable that gives you more numerical accuracy. I am showing you the computation of the initial data for a rotating Newton star, and here you have the configuration of the physical parameters. We are using spherical orthonormal coordinates, and what you can see here is that we were able to really solve the radial profiles. Here you have radial profiles at the equator of the different variables we do solve in the elliptic equations, which are this conformal factor, this combination of laps and conformal factor, and this new variable, this v vector. Actually, the only non-zero component of the v vector is the third one. That's why I only plot this quantity. And you see that we get very smooth and consistent data. We check this initial data with other code called Loren, which use spectral, it's a spectral code, so it's very accurate for smooth data. And we get a very, very good accuracy, numerical accuracy. Then you can, from these variables, recover the variables that do appear in the metric of the space-time. So you have this Laplace function. Sorry, well, here it's a typo. Here you should have this conformal factor, this Laplace function, and this shift vector that can be recovered from the v vector. And again, everything is smooth and everything is consistent with the solution obtained by other codes like the spectral code Loren. You can also get some new information that's very interesting. You can get a solution for this variable x, and you again have this very smooth profile. This is the only non-zero component of the x vector, and you have an extra variable, which is the time evolution of this vector. Here, if we were really doing stationary initial data, so let's say not neglecting the evolution terms encoding the gravitational radiation, we should get that this the evolution in time of this variable should be zero. What we get, so here what I am plotting is the first and the in the second column of this slice, I am plotting the radial profile at the equator of the first and second components of the dot x vector. And you see that they are very smooth, they are consistent with the fact that we are doing an approximation, not really solving the evolution equations yet. But what you can see is that the estimate of this elliptic equation gives you an idea of how stationary are your initial data. And here you can see that the values of this time derivative are of the order of 10 to the minus 10 in comparison with the values 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 3 that you have in the vector x. So even before doing any evolution of your system, you have an idea of how close to stationarity you are with this initial data. So let me finish with some conclusions. I hope I was able to give some very basic ideas of the different approaches that we used in numerical relativity to solve Einstein equations, which are the free evolution schemes and the constraint schemes. Even if you use a free evolution scheme because you don't like elliptic equations too much, but I just tell you it's not too bad. You can get used to solve them and there are no problems. But then in a way, even in the case you are using free evolution schemes, you need to solve constraint equations in order to generate initial data. So even in that case, the analysis of these constraint schemes are very important. I tried to show you this CFC scheme that is used in order to, let's say, for example, to generate this initial data. It was very, very used to generate initial data or modifications, small modifications, or similar, let's say, approaches to this CFC scheme. So the original equations of the CFC scheme suffer from local uniqueness problem, which can have a very huge impact in numerical simulations. And you can fix that problem with a so-called extended version of this scheme. And then when you go to the fully relativistic scheme, not having any more an approximation, you can consider the so-called fully constrained formalism. This formulation has a very similar elliptic sector of the conformally flat to this extended conformally flat condition scheme. So you keep these good properties, local uniqueness, hierarchical structure of the elliptic sector, and then you have another additional hyperbolic sector. We are now analyzing the numerical accuracy potential problem in the hyperbolic sector, and with the definition of new variables, we were able to keep the good properties in the elliptic sector, but improving the accuracy with respect to previous elliptic equations, let's say. And on the other hand, this is a work in progress. We are also analyzing the accuracy, the numerical accuracy in the hyperbolic sector. We have solved one of the equations, and we are still working or thinking about the other sector. But even if we cannot solve completely the problem, we are improving the numerical accuracy in general, and we may have an idea of having an estimate of the tensor encoding the gravitational radiation. And why this is important? Because let's say of the future steps and things we want to explore. So we are interested now not only in this, let's say, more simplified initial data solutions, but to check the accuracy of our equations in a more complex numerical simulations. And this is important because of the new generation of gravitational wave observatories and the coming new detections of gravitational waves. We need more accuracy in our numerical simulations. And then we also want to have to do something that I think no one has done before, and correct me if I am wrong, which is check some remaining constraints which are related to the determinant of some variables and, let's say, more algebraic and differential constraints that are not checked in the literature. At least I am not aware of that. And then also, this point of half an estimation of an estimate of the gravitational radiation of the system without solving the evolution equations is something we want to analyze and to study deeper, because it can be, for example, a very nice tool to have an idea of this estimate in examples where the evolution equations are just impossible, which are the cosmological applications. So in cosmological applications, it's impossible to have enough numerical resolution and enough time, computational resources to evolve in time the evolution equations for all the time you need to in order to have some information. So this is something still, let's say, work in progress, but something very interesting that again can connect some more theoretical and numerical work with very important applications in astrophysics. So let me finish saying thank you very much for your attention. It's a online webinar, and this is always a little difficult to follow. The talk was a little theoretical, so it's also thank you, extra thanks. And I just want to finish saying we are looking forward to visit the Perimeter Institute, and I have this book, this new book for Christmas. So I will have a look and I will be ready to enjoy the visit to the Perimeter, to work with all the people there. I love multidisciplinary works, so I am looking forward to work with the people there and to learn from you and from and to have a very wonderful experience. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Isabel. Thanks, that was fine. And hopefully you'll be able to use that book pretty soon. So, okay, as you said, yes, everything online is a bit challenging, but unfortunately we have been kind of getting a lot of practice. So questions from the audience are usually either you raise your hand or you can type it in the chat and I can see that. So who wants to go? Okay, as while people, okay, Lauren, please go ahead.
Hello, Isabel, thanks for this very nice talk. I mean, here you talked about 3+1, but earlier on you mentioned 2+2, you know, foliation and approach. So can you say a little bit more about, is it useful numerically to think in that way? Because as a theoretician, 2+2, it's kind of very useful, but
yes. So from a numerical, well, this is a very good question, so thank you very much. From a numerical point of view, it is very important, for example, if you want to extract gravitational radiation in a correct way, but you have the problem of caustics, I think this is the term. So if you consider numerical, let's say astrophysical scenarios containing black holes, then the null cone foliation can intersect the let's say this hypersurface in null of null cones can intersect among them, and this can lead basically to the impossibility of numerically solving the equations. So what it is done, well, Luis knows a lot about this, but this is called, I think, the Cauchy, well, I am not sure now about the name, but basically what you do is just, you consider a central part where you put 3+1. Mm-hmm. And then you match with a boundary, and from that boundary out, you consider a null foliation. So somehow you have the best of the two approaches. Mm-hmm. You have a good, let's say, a good evolution in the central part where the null foliation can give you problems because of this intersection of null cones. But on the other hand, let's say far from, I don't know, these black holes or these compact objects, you have a foliation which allows you to determine in a nicer way the gravitational radiation of the system. This is done. The people use that. You have some problems maybe about how you do with this boundary, this matching. You need to be very careful at the matching. Then depending if the grid in the first part and the grid in the second part is very different, then you need to be, let's say, you need to take care about how you really match these two parts. And also, it depends a lot on how you want to, let's say, increase complexity. You can have a very different or very complex structure in the central part with adaptive mesh refinement or whatever in order to try to be numerically more efficient. So from a numerical point of view, if you have black holes, you will have problems at the central part, no? From a theoretical point of view, it was very, very important in order to really understand what are the gravitational waves. And for example, the variable, these vile scalars that we use in numerical relativity to show which is the gravitational radiation of the system, is due because of a Neumann-Perros formulation, which was based on this null cons, this 2+2 foliation. So still, I would say, that's my opinion. I will not forget about something because people don't use that. Maybe you can still get some good properties of part of this structure.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Luis,
you don't have the mic on.
Sorry. Just to add one piece there, is applications, numerical criteria applications for holography, by and large, are done with this formulation, with the characteristic formulation, but just a different corner. On the astrophysics applications, as Isabel was saying, is dominated by 3+1 for the reasons that she was giving.
Yeah. On the other hand, when you talk about formulations in general, you may have a particular scenario in mind, but don't forget that there are a lot of scenarios like cosmological applications, holography, or even from a theoretical point of view, these kind of explorations or works based on fundamental, let's say, properties of the equations. There are not a lot of people doing that, but I think it's like if we finally find something important, it can be a benefit for everyone.
Maybe just a related question. So you mentioned this matching condition. Are the challenges, is there like fundamental theoretical challenges left there, or it's purely numerical?
Both. I mean, I am not an expert because I work more in constraint formulations, but for example, boundary conditions. I mean, boundary conditions can be a mess from a numerical point of view, but also, maybe Luis can say something more, but I am very curious about how to control the violation of the constraints when you have these boundary conditions and you need to do the match in a proper way. So I would say it's not so direct, but there are simulations. So it's true that they were able to really find the compatible and consistent conditions to do that.
Yeah, since you ping me, there are two flavors, Laurent. One is called Cauchy characteristic extraction, and the other one is Cauchy characteristic matching. So match isn't where you do the full matching. You're evolving both sides, and then you're covering the full space-time that is included in the computational domain. In the extraction, you're only talking to the Cauchy, getting information and propagating all the way to infinity. So that's easy. That is working. Well, easy. Not. That's clean. People have done it. For the full matching, there are still mathematical and even physical challenges that have not been resolved.
I mean, here the point is that, for example, the numerical properties of numerical stability of the system are very, very challenging, very challenging. And this is something I am working now also, but it is not finished. But these gauge variables are very weird because it's something that you can choose as you want, but the choice you decide does not guarantee, for example, that the Schwarzschild is stationary in that coordinate, in that system, in that gauge, let's say. So it's not easy to put together nice equations from a theoretical point of view, also very efficient and practical from a numerical point of view. So it's really difficult to really to do this matching. And I guess that there are a lot of numerical instabilities going on there also.
Thank you. Another question? So I have one, Isabel. So at the very top of your talk, when you describe elliptic equations and how the information propagates instantaneously, so now if I move forward and then say I'm now using and kind of connecting with what we were just talking about, boundary conditions. So if you now use a fully constrained evolution or even partially constrained evolution, now I'm very sensitive to the type of boundary condition I'm giving. So what in the free evolution scheme will take some time to affect the interior, now it does it instantaneously. So do you have any kind of maybe formal argument of how one should go forward, or how should one try and find a way to that information, which we don't know of, which is the boundary conditions, the physical boundary conditions for the problem at hand. How do we deal with the potential pathologies that will be introduced by the very use of the formulation?
Okay, so let me think about all the possible answers because there are several issues here. So for example, boundary conditions of the elliptic equations are placed in a spatial infinity, and there they are very well known. So we should not have problem there. If you want to think about, for example, black holes where you have inner boundary conditions, then this is different. And here, there is no conceptual problem because the Lax function, the shift vector, are gauge variables. And then you have the freedom to choose them. So let's say you don't have consistency problems in general, but the way you choose these values can be critical. Here, there are geometrical arguments behind. So for example, the way we solve the Lax function for the elliptic equation gives you some good properties about avoiding touching singularities and so on. So let's say from a conceptual point of view, I don't see problems in solving some of the elliptic equations. Then for the conformal factor, we can derive an evolution equation for the conformal factor, even if we don't need that. It's like you can derive an evolution equation even if actually this degree of freedom is artificial in the sense that it's given by the other components. But this evolution equation for the conformal factor can be used to derive consistent boundary conditions for this elliptic equation. So let's say in general, with not too many details, you have two things. Like you have the freedom to put whatever you want, and then it is more like a numerical problem. Or you have some tools in order to derive which is the right value to put there. So at least in the structure of this fully constrained formalism, I don't see conceptual problems, let's say from a theoretical point of view. Then from a numerical point of view, which was actually, I think, a big problem, people not to use these formulations. We were working with this new method to solve elliptic equations in finite difference grids, and we were having the capacity of parallelization with this method. And actually, this method was very stable. Remember that these elliptic equations are related to metric variables, so we don't expect discontinuities. So if you have this warranty of local uniqueness and you use a numerical method which is more or less stable, I don't expect numerical problems. Then the point here is that when you have, let's say, inner boundary conditions like a black hole and you do excision and you put these inner boundary conditions, This is a new window. I would say this is the other work I am thinking about, but because of all the teaching, let's see if I can get to it. But here the idea is more like exploration. So we have the choice to determine, to give a value for this inner boundary. And this will imply that you are just using a different slicing of your space-time. And maybe this can be a way of avoiding some adaptive mesh refinement or other way. The point here is that because the equations are so complex and we are learning like step by step of these equations, we need really to explore a lot of things regarding these constraint schemes. But potentially you can get surprised, you can get new ways of slicing space-time. And the good point of this is that maybe this new slicing can be also useful even for free evolution schemes. This is something I have been thinking about a lot of time. It is very difficult because it's not trivial at all which kind of values you can put in these boundary conditions. for these boundary conditions, but it's something that if you get something very good, maybe you can save a lot of time and money. I don't know if I completely answered your question, Luis.
No, I mean, I don't think there is a very sharp answer to the question I had. So I think that I wanted to take a look at what your thoughts are. So we could perhaps. I mean, this is something that we definitely will be chatting about when you come.
Yeah.
So Laurent, you still have your hands up? Do you have another question?
I mean, if somebody else doesn't have a question. You mentioned earlier that the possibility of shock waves. So I guess, can you say a bit more when they develop and then how often? And I guess in that case, your numerical scheme cannot work through.
Thank you. So the shock waves appear in the matter content. So for the Einstein equations, you can have discontinuities in the source term, but this will not imply discontinuity in the variable itself of metric of space-time. Okay. So for the Einstein equations, let's say you need to be able to encode these discontinuities as a discontinuous profile in the source term, but it's not a big deal, let's say. But the point here is what you include in the matter content. And for the matter content, so evolution of density, energy, momentum, electric and magnetic fields and everything you want to consider, then it can be very critic. And then you need to use what is called high-resolution shock capturing schemes, which are based on the eigenvalues and eigenvectors of the evolution of this matter content to tell you how to really recover the propagation of these discontinuities in the matter content. So let's say it's not a problem of Einstein equations directly, but usually you don't solve Einstein equations only. So you do solve Einstein equations with a lot of things in addition. And for this new equations that tell you how matter evolves, then you need to take care about that. And there are these high resolution shock capturing schemes. For example, now I am working also in a better numerical method in order to include resistivity in the relativistic magneto-hydrodynamic equations. And actually I am working with a group of people in Malaga, in Spain, that they use GPU. So it's like another world. You have the world of Einstein equations, then you have the world of hydrodynamic equations. And at the end, the nice point is you need everything. So that's why it's so important to have a multidisciplinary group of people which experts in all of these parts. But in the case of Einstein equations, discontinuities appear as source term for the evolution, for the derivatives, so they don't imply a discontinuity in the variable of a space, of the metric of space-time itself.
Thank you, Isa. One last question from Ramiro.
Okay, thank you. Hi, Isabel. Thank you for the talk. It was very nice.
So, thank you very much.
Since we're talking from going from hyperbolic to elliptic equations, I remember not so long ago I heard a talk about someone who's treating solving the initial value problem of a 3+1 problem as an evolution set of equations in 2+1, right? So I was wondering if by using that sort of formalism, you can learn something that would help you in your fully constrained system, or if there's something that you can talk about of that relation there.
Okay, I don't understand the first part of the question. You were talking about simulations in free evolution schemes?
In 3+1 evolution schemes are hyperbolic, so you do evolution. But so I don't know if you've heard of this, but someone was able to write the initial data problem, like the solving the constraints initially, as a set of evolution equations. So you can write that as hyperbolic. So basically, you can see that as a 2+1 system, and you can evolve like that in that sense.
I don't know too much about that. Sorry,
maybe
but I am curious because in the case of initial data, usually you solve elliptic kind of elliptic equations. In the case of hyperbolic equations, you need to get to some stationarity of the equations. I'm not sure about, I don't know, sorry.
I don't know, maybe Luis can maybe he remembers
work,
better.
This is the work by István Rax and Winokur, where they introduce on the given hypersurface that you're solving an elliptic, introduce a special foliation and turn the elliptic equations into hyperbolic, marching into a particular direction of a level set of the hypersurface.
But in during, let's say, you keep the 3+1, you don't go to 2+2 or something like that.
No, just imagine that given hypersurface, stay on the hypersurface.
Uh-huh.
Now you turn your elliptic constraints into a flow set of constraints where they have now become hyperbolic on the slice.
Okay.
So that's what Ramir is saying, the 2+1. So if you imagine doing a spherical symmetry, then you will march in this direction. Now your radial direction becomes your time direction.
Okay. Okay, I don't know the details. But I cannot tell you too much more, sorry.
Okay. No, that's okay. It's just think that it could be like useful sometimes, maybe think like...
Yeah, know. Usually what I can comment is that in my experience, any different approach, let's say any good point you get in one approach, it has consequences and good points in other approaches, because at the end you learn something about the structure of space-time or the structure or the properties of some gauge. And then you can for sure use part of this, let's say, knowledge in other approaches. So I really think about that, even if I don't know the details. But in any time, in any approach, when you learn something, if it is, let's say, something deep, for sure you can try to get that information on the other approach.
Okay, thank you very much.
Welcome.
Well, okay, so thanks, Isabel. It was great having you, even though online. Looking forward to you being here. And today is the last colloquium of the year. So for everyone, happy holidays, and let's hope we start a great 2021. So thanks, everyone.
Thank you very much, Luis. Thank you, everyone, for listening.
Bye-bye. Bye, everyone.
Bye.